We're in our Roman series, working our way through the book of Romans, and this is our fourth look at this book. And last week we slowed down a little bit and we looked at just two verses, verse 16 and 17, and we saw that those two verses are the thesis statement of the whole book. It's Paul's main point, and his main point was that the great message, the gospel, is not primarily good advice. It's not a call from God to us for moral conformity first or for even religious commitment, but it's actually good news. It's a herald, a messenger coming over the hill and making a pronouncement about something that's happened. And what happened is the gospel. It's Jesus Christ, death, life, death, and resurrection for us, and that's the good news. And this week we also look at news. But it's not good news, it's bad news. It's the wrath of God. And I was going to try to say the word wrath like Scottish people say it, but then I practiced and it didn't work well, so I decided not to. There's a special way of saying wrath here, I know, but I'm just going to stick to my American version. The wrath of God is the bad news today. And, you know, this is every Puritan preacher's favorite subject. But seriously, we have to focus on it. We need to focus on it because it's here. It's right there in the text. And it's one of the main points that Paul's making in this book. And also, it's a fact. The wrath of God is a fact that has to be dealt with. And there's a lot of caricatures about what we think about when we think about God's wrath out there. And so we need to come to the Bible and see what Paul has to say about God's wrath here. And the point of the text is pretty simple, actually. It's in line with last week's point because it follows directly on. And that's that if you want to talk about salvation, you got to talk about being saved from something. And that something from which human beings are saved, Paul's telling us here, is the wrath of God. So let's think about God's wrath for a little bit this morning together, and we're going to ask, what is it? Its definition, what's the wrath of God? And then we're going to ask, why is it? And Paul's answer to that question is because every single human being knows God and doesn't know God at the very same time. And then we're going to ask, where is it? And Paul's answer here in the very first verse is that the wrath of God is being revealed, present tense, right now. And so we need to figure out, where is it being revealed? Exactly. What does he mean by that? So what is it, why is it, and where is it? And let's first ask, what is God's wrath, its definition? Now, it's tricky when you talk about God's wrath. Verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. It's tricky when you talk about it because God's wrath is not like our wrath. It's not like human wrath at all. There are all sorts of degrees of human wrath. But at its very worst, human wrath is a spontaneous rage. It's volcanic eruption, right? It's getting so full of anger that you brim over and explode. And it can be expressed in all sorts of ways, but we think of the word wrath when we talk about human wrath like a bull in a china shop type anger. Just pouring over like lava from a volcano. And, you know, it could be expressed in all sorts of ways, but at its very worst, it's rage. It's deep rage, right? But God's not like that. So one of the things that the theologians will consistently remind us of is that we can't read our emotional life, our emotional experiences back into God. We don't read it that way. We don't project our own attributes back into the very life of God, that he's absolutely different from us, absolutely other from us. And one of the key things is that God's attributes, who he is, all his characteristics, they are all entirely one. So just as much as God is justice, he is love. And just as much as he is love, he is just. And just as much as he is both of those, he is glorious. And just as much as he is glorious, he is holy. And all of those things exist, are God, always at the very same time. And so the big difference in human wrath and God's wrath is that, well, we all know, we've experienced this. We can be wrathful. We can spill over like a volcano, and it's a zero-sum game for us in that we can be completely wrathful without any love, but not so with God. When God expresses his wrath, he is just as much perfect love at the very same time. When he is being fully just and in expressing anger and wrath, he is love. And when he is just, he is glorious. And when he is glorious, he is holy. And when he is holy, he is love and just and glory. And all at the same time, he is always one. He's changeless, you see. And so when we express wrath, we might, it could be just, but for us it could be loveless, but never so for God. God is always both simultaneously completely loving and just in expressing wrath at the very same time. And so the word here that Paul uses is the common word throughout the Bible for wrath, and it's a little Greek word, orge, and it comes often, especially in the Old Testament, right alongside another word, and it's the word that we translate anger. And so often in the Old Testament, you'll see God's anger and God's wrath listed side by side, and like in the Psalms, in a kind of parallel sort of way. And one of the reasons for that, this is so important, although a small point, is that God's wrath is not one of God's attributes. God's wrath is not one of God's attributes. God is just. God is just, and the expression of God's justice towards unjust actions in this world is his wrath. And you see, so wrath simply means punishment. And that's what it means here. For the wrath of God, it's the punishment of God has been revealed. And so wrath and punishment are not an attribute of God. They're the expression externally of God's justice, because he is just. That's what he is. And so wrath is very simply an expression of God's justice in punishment towards sin. And so anger is God's emotional response to injustice, and wrath is his punishment of injustice, his just response to injustice. That's God's wrath. Hopefully that is simple enough, although we're talking about God, so it's not simple at all. It's very difficult. But he's always just, he's always love, and he's always good all at the very same time. It's completely unlike our wrath. And so we can't caricature it like it often gets caricatured in the popular world. And what that means, and I take this from kind of reading a whole Old Testament reading alongside Paul here, and that's that God's wrath is never revenge. God's wrath is never revenge. God's wrath is never spontaneous outrage. He doesn't have emotional outbursts, and he doesn't act out of revenge. It's never either of those. And you can, look, one of the great ways to see this is that you can go to the Old Testament law code and look at how unique the Old Testament law code was among ancient Near Eastern law codes. And Old Testament scholars have repeatedly said this, that when you look at the way God set up Israelite society in the Old Testament, that it's unlike anything else that had ever existed. And that's because, for instance, in Leviticus 19, God gives all these laws, law after law after law, about how to structure the society and how to punish crime like any good society would have, right? And at the end of that, in Leviticus 19, 17, and 18, he says, now, in enacting these laws, do not hate your neighbor and never take revenge. In other words, he's saying, when you structure your society and you have all these laws that govern it, never act, even against criminals, out of revenge or hatred, but only justice. In other words, the punishment, as we in a cliche way always say, the punishment should fit the crime, right? That's justice. And that was unique in all of history to the Israelite community. No other ancient society worked like that. And one of the most incredibly compassionate ways that this works out, that God, as an expression of his justice, not revenge, not hatred for the sinner or the criminal, but simple justice, what is fitting, right? One of the ways this was expressed in a really remarkable way is in the idea of the cities of refuge. So if you've read, you know, the Genesis to Deuteronomy, you'll remember the cities of refuge idea. God comes to Israel and he says, look, if you accidentally kill another person, you know, we call that, I think, well, in the States we call that manslaughter. I assume it's the same here. If you accidentally kill another person, naturally, this was the law of the land in the ancient Near East, naturally, the spouse or whoever, the family member, is going to want to come and take revenge on you and kill you because you, even if it was an accident, in some type of farming accident or whatever, you accidentally killed them. And he says, but look, that's not justice. You do not deserve to have capital punishment committed against you but if you accidentally killed somebody. And so God said, set up these cities of refuge all over Israelite territory. And if this happens to you, you can flee to one of these cities, and the people there are required to protect you, not only so that an injustice won't be committed against you, but so that the family of the victim who are so angry will not be given the opportunity to seek revenge. They'll be protected themselves from committing a further injustice and seeking a punishment that's not fitting against you, you see. Now, this might not sound as revolutionary to you now, but look, this nothing like this had ever existed in the ancient world, and it reflected God's own personality, that God's wrath is never an exhibition of revenge or hatred, of casting people down just for the sake of it, or anything like that. It's a reflection of the fact that God is just, absolute justice, and that sinning against absolute justice means punishment is fitting. And we all know that intuitively, that's true, that makes sense. Now, maybe you're thinking, hold on a minute, what about Romans 12? Maybe you're not, so I'll tell you what you're thinking if you're not thinking it. And that's that in Romans 12, God says, through Paul, never repay evil for evil, for vengeance is mine, declares the Lord. And he does say that, but the word that gets translated there, vengeance, comes from the root word, it's a verb for justice. And, you know, if you open up like a dictionary that's different possible ways to translate this word, they'll tell you very quickly that it simply means to satisfy justice. And so another way to say it is he says, never repay evil for evil. The satisfaction of justice is mine. In other words, you human being, don't need to go out and try to make every unjust situation into a just situation through punishment. I will do that. In the end of time, he says there in Romans 12. So it means the exact same thing that we've been saying about God's wrath, that it's never revenge, it's never outrageous, spontaneous rage, it's always according to justice, where it's fitting. Now, just to close this first point, you know, this idea of punishment, just punishment in the face of sin, you know, it makes so much sense. It makes so much sense to all of us because, our very society is rooted in this most basic idea, as every society that's worked in all of history has been, that we set up court systems and police systems because we know that crime demands just response. And the reason societies exist like this is because they reflect God's own person, because he is absolute justice, and they reflect in a really imperfect way. But look, we even know this to be true in our own personal lives. We know in our own personal lives that anytime somebody commits unjust acts against us, or we commit an unjust act against somebody else, that sin never goes without some type of punishment. Never, because even when you decide to forgive somebody instead of pursuing the full weight of your wrath against them or whatever it might be, or the law if it's a criminal issue, even when you decide to simply forgive, it's not like the punishment just disappears. Where does it go? You swallow it. You're the one that has to take it in forgiveness. You swallow it, and it goes deep down into your gut, and you feel the pain of being sinned against, and no justice, no retribution, nothing. You take it in your own being, and you feel the weight of that punishment, and it hurts, and it's hard, and that's part and parcel of forgiveness. I mean, this is just true, right? And so the first point is simply to say that we can't caricature God's wrath. God's wrath is righteous response to injustice, to sin, because he is just, because he's just, it's fitting, right? Okay, so that's the definition of God's wrath in the Bible that Paul introduces here. But secondly, why God's wrath? And Paul's answer here in verse 18, 19, and 20 is because we know God, but at the very same time, we don't know God. So he says, for what can be known about God is plain. His eternal power, his divine attributes have been clearly perceived ever since creation in the things that have been made. And although we know God, we suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now, Paul here is describing how human beings know God. And a lot of people have come to these couple of verses here, especially verse 19 and 20, and said that it says what can be known about God. In other words, that what Paul is saying here is that the knowledge of God, that, you know, the simple knowledge that he exists is at least possible. And from that, people have sought validation in constructing what we think of as traditional rational arguments for the existence of God. And many of you have heard these arguments, you know these arguments, you're familiar with them. They might be new to some of you, but you've probably heard them down the grapevine in some form. And, you know, they go way back. They go all the way back to Aristotle, a couple hundred years before Jesus was born. And they've been modified throughout history, and people like Anselm and Thomas Aquinas and Immanuel Kant and other people in the modern world. And here, I mean, there's truth there. Paul is saying you can go out and look at the natural order, the created natural order, the movement of the heavens, and actually say something about God. And, you know, probably the two arguments that correspond to what Paul's saying here most closely is the what we call the cosmological argument and the teleological argument. Now, those are fancy words, but they're pretty simple ideas. The cosmological argument, which you've definitely heard at some point, is simply that, that everything that happens in the world has some type of cause behind it. Everything that happens in your life has some type of cause. Every effect has a cause. And if you reach back far enough and you look for the cause behind the cause behind the cause behind the cause, eventually you have to ask, well, what caused the world? And the only thing you can possibly say is that there has to be some type of uncaused cause, some original first cause that wasn't himself caused, right? Makes sense? That every effect has a cause, but there has to be a first cause. There has to be somebody who started it all, right? And that somebody that started it all is God, right? That's the cosmological argument. Or there's the teleological argument, which is works a little better probably, and it's also today known as the fine-tuning argument. And that's similar, that, you know, the earth and the sun are so far apart, and the earth and the moon are so far apart, and the gravitational pull is negative 9.8 meters per second. And if any of those things were off by 1/1,000,000th of a decimal point, then the earth would have never been possible. And from what I'm told by scientists, apparently that's pretty much true. And the sun would have just blown up, and we never would have existed. And, you know, when you look at how fine-tuned it all is, there must be a God standing behind it all, somebody standing behind it all. Or how could it possibly be? What are the chances? They're, one in trillions, scientists say, and that's ridiculous. So probably there must have been. And, you know, now, maybe these arguments are helpful to you. I don't know. You've probably heard them before. Maybe they're not. For some people, that they seem to be persuasive, and for others, they aren't. But I do think that you can say something like that based off that Paul is giving us some validation here for looking out at the world and saying, yeah, I mean, the existence of God makes a lot of sense. But he's not just saying that. He's saying something more profound than that, because he's not just saying here that the knowledge of God is possible. He's saying here that every single human knows God. Not just that they can know God if they think about it long enough. He's saying here that every single person knows God and has suppressed that truth in unrighteousness. And, you know, that's why theologians and others have consistently come and said that what Paul's talking about here is not just some rational ability to reason to God, to look out at nature and form a syllogism of some sort and say, yeah, God must exist. He's saying more than that. He's saying that all of you know God by nature, by the very fact of simply being human. And historically, we've called this intuitive knowledge of God, that every single person has an intuitive knowledge of God. You know, he says that they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. You can't suppress something that you don't have in the first place. That everybody has it. Now, there are all sorts of stories of belief that of people coming from atheism or agnosticism or something like that into a position of faith in Jesus that confirm this type of idea of intuitive God knowledge that all human beings possess. A.N. Wilson is one of the great examples. Many of you will be familiar with him. He is a journalist, English journalist, biographer, book writer. You'll see his books in the windows of places like Blackwell's and Waterstones. And in 2009, A.N. Wilson came to faith in Jesus. And he had been raised in a religious home, but in his mid-30s, he had come out and said that he didn't believe that he was an atheist, that he was thoroughly convinced. And he writes about his conversion to Christianity in 2009 in a newspaper called The New Statesman. And in it, he says, in my 30s, I had laughed off all the arguments for God's existence. David Hume and Immanuel Kant had made short work of the cosmological argument. But then, he said, I realized that belief was not a matter of rational argument, that it involves the whole person. And so I was drawn over and over again to the disconcerting recognition that so very many of the people that I had most admired and loved in life had been believers. And then secondly, I was drawn back in by my experience of beauty. He said, I would listen to Bach and Mozart, and that beauty impressed me to the reality that I did indeed always believe in the beautiful, capital B, some absolute sense of beauty. I couldn't get at beauty otherwise. I didn't know where to go to say this is beautiful, is what he's saying. Carl Jung, another German philosopher in the 20th century, he says something similar. He says when he came to believe in God, that he realized that arguing for God's existence was almost like arguing to somebody that a sunset is beautiful. It just is. How do you do that? How do you convince somebody that what they're looking at is beautiful? Wilson says, then I was watching a whole cluster of friends and my own mother die over quite a short period of time, and that convinced me of what I always knew, that a purely materialist explanation for our mysterious human existence simply would not do. That I didn't even know how to think that there was injustice and evil and suffering in the world unless I first believed in some absolute good. And I knew it all along, he says. And then, finally, he was writing a book on Nazi Germany a decade or so ago, and he was going through Hitler's, he writes, insane atheistic ravings. And then, alongside Hitler, I read Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book on ethics, and I asked myself, what sort of a mad world is created by those who think that ethics is purely a human construct? I was convinced that it was only the Christians who made sense to me in their pronouncements about against Nazism based on absolute morality. And so he says, I realized that my conversion was middle-aged madness, my conversion to atheism. It was middle-aged madness. I was denying what I could never escape, that I did at base need to believe in God in order to be mad at God, you see. And C.S. Lewis, if you've ever read his conversion story, I mean, he says almost the exact same thing. He says that, you know, he was really struggling with suffering in his life and evil. And he said, but what I realized was I needed to believe in absolute good in order to even shake my fist at God in the first place. That he intuitively knew the reality of the absolute, the supernatural, the whole time. And there's story after story like this. And so, look, you never have to convince a child to believe in something that they can't see. Every single child comes into this world by nature believing in the fantastical, believing in the supernatural. Every single child does. You never have to convince a child. You see, atheism, disbelief, saying that nature does not exist is something that you have to learn. It's not intuitive. It's against our own nature. It's not natural at all. It's unnatural. And so that's why theologians historically have said that Paul here, he's talking about something more than just rational argument for God's existence. He's saying that all of us possess intuitive belief, and it comes through the ideals of beauty, the mystery of human consciousness, the deep need for the supernatural, the deep need for spirituality and purpose and meaning and the hope of ultimate justice, and for the story that we are all so attracted to, the story of the hero who redeems, which gets played over and over and over again in every great novel and film. It's the thing we can't stop wanting because it's true, because it's intuitive. We all believe by nature. And so, why God's wrath? Why God's wrath? And the answer here is because we all know, but we don't want to know. He's saying, we all know, but we suppress that knowledge in sin. We push it down as it pushes into our hearts. And who is the they? Look, this is so important to see. Who is the they that Paul is talking about here throughout this passage? The they, for what can be known about God is plain to them. Who's the them? And to know the answer to that, you have to reach back into verse 16 and 17. And there he says who the they is, and the they is Jew and Gentile. In other words, in Paul's ancient category, who's a Jew and Gentile? Well, that's everybody. You're a Jew or a Gentile, one or the other. He's saying everybody knows God, and everybody, you, me, has suppressed the truth. Not just atheists, but everybody. And so there's a lot of different ways to do that. That's what he's talking about here. One of the ways is to say, I don't believe God exists. We call that atheism. But that's not the only way. I mean, he mentions other ways here in the passage, in verse 22 and 23, that you start to worship things like creatures, birds, and trees, and rocks. I mean, that's a more ancient way of saying no to God, of suppressing the truth that you know in unrighteousness. But, you know, the more modern way, we don't do that way as much anymore, although it still exists. But there's a modern correspondence to that way, and that's worshiping, desiring above all else our own accomplishments and making them into God. It's sex and money and power and beauty. That's the modern replacement for birds and trees and stones. It's everybody, all of us, is what Paul's saying here. And at the root of it, it's the desire to be autonomous, to be self-governing. In other words, it's not ever that anybody truly doesn't believe in the supernatural and what they can't see in some absolute. It's not that at all. It's that we want to have power. We want to have power over that. And that's exactly what you see in the root of sin in Genesis 3, in Genesis 11, when Satan says, do you want to be like God? Not do you want to be under God's authority, but Eve said, I want to be like him. I want to rise up to the heavens. I want to build a ziggurat, a tower like they did in Genesis 11 and replace God. It's a power play, as the postmodernists often say. It's a power play. And it's true of all of us. And that's what Paul's saying here. Okay, so finally and briefly, where is it? Where is God's wrath? Now, the key thing to see here is that in verse 18, it's more present tense than you can even see here in the ESV. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Well, it's even more than, it's the wrath of God literally is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, which means that the wrath of God is being revealed right now. And so where is it being revealed? And the answer to that is, look, Paul's saying you can look out at nature, look out at the created order, and you can see the attributes of God on display. And if you had truly the eyes to see, you could see God clearly in all of his works in the natural world, in the created order. You can see his power. You can see his divinity, all these things. But when you look out at the natural world, you don't just see God's attributes on display. You see more than that. You see something in addition to that. What do you see? You see hurricanes and tornadoes and whirlpools and droughts and tsunamis, and you see water moccasins and coral snakes. Those are poisonous, by the way. You see the law of the jungle, right? Just watch a Disney movie. You see the law of the jungle. Just look all around you. You see broken competition, broken relationships, struggles at work. You see cancer. You see death. Where is the wrath of God revealed? Well, it's not just that you look out at nature and see the attributes of God. You look out at nature and see the wrath of God. It's all around us. If you don't see it, you're not alive. We all feel it. We experience it. We know it. It pushes against us all the time, every morning when we get up, and it's so hard. That is the wrath of God that is always being revealed. And we know that because Genesis 3, this world that we live in, which has the law of the jungle at its heart in some ways, is based off the curse of Genesis 3. And that curse had three or four elements to it. The first was that God cursed the ground, literally. He cursed the natural world. That's the punishment of God for sin revealed. He cursed the natural world, and that means that everything we do in relationship to the world fights against us. It pushes back. It's not as bad as it could be, but it's not good. And then he cursed the relationship between husband and wife, that they would be at enmity and that they would struggle over power, with power over one another in a bad way. And so our relationships are broken. That's the wrath of God revealed. He says childbearing, the natural processes of bringing humans into this world, it's broken. It's the wrath of God revealed. He said that it all ends in banishment from his presence and death. And that's the wrath of God revealed. Just listen to Herman Bavinck on the wrath of God today, just as we begin to close. Sin for us today means separation from God in each of our lives. It means darkness and ignorance and error and deception and fear and disquietude and a sense of guilt. Have you ever felt any of these? Regret, misery, enslavement. It means even the dominion of Satan, that God gave the territory of this world to Satan and his powers, John 12:31 says, because of human sin. This is, today, the very wrath of God revealed. Now, to close, the main point of the text is in one little preposition. The first word of verse 18, for. Paul has said this little word for six times already in the past five or six verses. And the reason he's doing that is because he started an argument back in 14 and 15. I'm eager to preach the gospel to you. For. There it is. It's the power unto salvation. Well, what do you mean, Paul? Well, for, he says again, for. It's the righteousness of God revealed. And then you see somebody's asking, why? But why? And now he's saying, for the wrath of God. You see, it's not, in your English Bible, it's separated by a new column and a title, but it's all one argument. And what he's saying is, when I say for the wrath of God is revealed against ungodliness, what I'm saying to you is the reason, the answer, the explanation of verse 16 and 17. Why the gospel has been revealed. In other words, there's no such thing as salvation unless you need to be saved from something. And his answer is, for the wrath of God is revealed to all of you. In other words, it brings us back to the same conclusion that we drew last week. Now, before we draw it in the last just couple of minutes here, you need to know this, that there has never in all of history, never, not yet, in all of history, never has God expressed the full weight of his wrath in his holy justice against a single sinful human being. Did you not once? He's never done it. Not yet. And we learn that from Romans 12. He says, I am storing the full weight of wrath. It has not been expressed yet unto the final day, a day out in the future. In Genesis 2, God said, if you sin against me, if you rebel against me, you will die. That's called, in the theological world, the fullness of death. And when Adam and Eve did it, they didn't get the fullness of death. Did you catch? All they got was curse, and every one of those curses was there to extend their life so that they could be permitted, so that it would be possible to be redeemed, you see? In other words, Bavinck, again, he talks about the double character of God. God is not willy-nilly, that's not what he means, but that in every single expression of God's wrath in this world, it has always been simultaneously compassionate, prolonging the days of human life, not giving them full death that they deserved. God has never, never meted out the full weight of justice, except for once. Except for once. And that's why he's connecting verse 18 to verse 16 and 17. The wrath of God is revealed not only to you. The wrath of God was revealed in its fullness only once, and that was put on the back of the Son of God himself. Only once in all of history so far. He, the Son of Man, got the full weight of God's wrath so that you could get the full gift of his righteousness. That was the point of the gospel in verse 16 and 17. It's the same point he's making right here. Only once. Look, the point is this. He has been so kind. He has been so kind since the very beginning to withhold his justice so that we might have hope. And in the middle of history, he gave us an answer. And every single human being stands before the end of time looking down the barrel at some future moment when God will extinguish the full weight of his wrath. And what he's saying to all of you here, all of you who face that reality, all of you, and everyone does, is that all you have to do is believe in the Son of Man, and that wrath will be pronounced satisfied for you. You won't face it. You won't face it. So you can believe and you can rest. And that's the point of Paul's passage here on the wrath of God. Let's pray. Father, we ask, Lord, that for some of us we would believe and rest for the first time, that we would know that our guilt is transferred in faith to the only man who's ever received the full weight of justice. And so we ask for this help to believe in Christ's name. Amen.